So these are some instructions that I'd like to offer about practice in daily life. Before I begin, I'd like to just express my appreciation for your practice over these past 5 days. Really want to honor that, and I also feel really, honored, privileged, blessed by the trust that that I feel that, you know, you've had in Stephen and I and in Melody to support you in your practice. It's very special to engage in this together. And being on retreat is something very precious and very special. It's not everybody has the opportunity to take this time and really focus, and it's kind of sacred time and sacred space. And very likely many of you had to, you know, arrange to be here and get people to take your responsibilities, whether it's family or work or whatever it is. So it took some effort to do, sure. So when we leave retreat and we're back in our daily lives, our routine, practice really feels different, and it can feel quite like we're on our own, you know, and some people feel a little isolated, or especially if you don't have a sangha, which is a word that means a practice community near you, easily accessible to you. It really is up to us, each one of us, to feed the flame of the Dharma within us. The Buddha said, as he was preparing to leave his community, and he was dying, and he told his assembly, he said, "Be a light unto yourselves. Be a light unto yourselves." So we really do need to take. We really do need to take the responsibility to find what we need within ourselves and around ourselves. So there's an expression in Buddhism which is taking refuge. And it's in Theravada Buddhism, it may not be done so formally as it is in some other traditions. It can be done formally, but many people go to retreats and don't formally take refuge. Take refuge has the sense of, you know, when I first started practicing, and it was with a Tibetan Lama, and I was told, you know, "Oh, we're going to go and take refuge." And I was completely new to practice, and I thought, "What is taking refuge? What does that mean? What is that all about?" It took me some time to begin to understand that really we're taking refuge from these floods that I mentioned in my Dharma talk, the floods that kind of overwhelm us and sweep us away. The drivenness that comes from within us and which drives the society around us. And we find and we take refuge, the three jewels that we take refuge in, are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So the Buddha is the, first of all, the original teacher of the Buddhist teachings. So recognizing that that someone realized awakening, realized freedom, realized cessation from suffering, and recognizing that that capacity is within each one of us. And so we take refuge in a way in the Buddha, but in the inner Buddha, the Buddha who is already present within us, and turning our attention and listening to our inner wisdom, learning to connect with the heart, learning to not divide ourselves from our true heart, from our true wisdom, our inner wisdom, and stay grounded in our authentic self. And the second refuge are the teachings. So the Dharma are the teachings that the Buddha gave. All of his teachings were given in a very specific context. He always gave teachings to people. So the Dharma is not only the Dharma that we read in books or that we hear in Dharma talks online, or, you know, maybe we go back and read the original Pali canon of, you know, the teachings of the Buddha, which is really a great thing to do. It's how the Dharma is unfolding within us. So it's not the Dharma as an abstract set of doctrines. It's the inner Dharma of liberation. So we take refuge in that inner process of discovering suffering and the end of suffering. You know, suffering, there's suffering. And what's, you know, let me shine the light of mindfulness on that and discover, you know, where is the craving beginning? Where is the clinging happening? Where is the resistance happening? And so shining the light of mindfulness brings us to the end of suffering. Because even if it's just in a moment, it's not the end forever, but the end in that moment, which is the how the end of suffering in a larger sense develops. It's moment by moment, in this moment, in the present moment. And then taking refuge in the Sangha. So connecting with people who are in the same way dedicated to a journey of awakening, and what that means to you. Some people are, you know, there are people who are, you know, on a very committed, in a very committed practice, and, you know, connecting with people in a practice community, or connecting with people who want to bring Buddhist values into the world, to apply, not in any sense to what's the word? Proselytize, not to proselytize Buddhist teachings, but to take social action, which is informed by compassion and kindness. Social action, which is informed by, you know, an attitude of not pointing the finger at the enemy, but actually trying to find solutions together, taking responsibility ourselves as well as, you know, looking at the problem and engaging with others. So I really think that's something that's so needed in our world, because there seems to be so much polarization in society, especially south of the border. And it also exists in Canada. And when we're polarized, we can't find the common ground and common values to work together. So I think Buddhism equips us to work for social change in a way that is loving and compassionate. Doesn't just keep that cycle of blame and, you know, pointing the finger at enemies going on and on. But it's difficult. It's not easy anyway. So, in our daily lives, I really think it's vital to have something of a daily practice. I mean, for me, you know, it's so nourishing. I wouldn't say that I never miss a day of sitting. I do try to sit every day, and I sit most days. And when I do, I'm always reminded of why it's so important to do so. Stephen mentioned we have so many human doings, but you know, we don't have enough human beings, and it's just that wonderful time, that nourishing time, just to drop into the simplicity of presence to ourselves, presence not to all our thoughts and patterns and habits and worries, but just to that life which is, you know, in every breath, life which is present in the whole body. So as a practice to cultivate, you know, if you're practicing with the breathing, continue to deepen in that practice, develop stability of attention. And in daily life practice, to stay connected to the body is really a great support. So we can do that by just having a sense of the breath being in the background, and just maintaining a sense of the whole body. In the Four Foundations of Mindfulness practice, in the section on the body, there are different practices to be mindful of the body, mindful in the body, and also to contemplate the body, like the four elements contemplation that we did last night. And then at the end, there's a phrase, or simply sufficient mindfulness to have the awareness there is a body. So just that simple kind of light presence of, you know, that we're in the body. And then our body tells us when we're moving into suffering. You know, the body contracts, the body is a great ally in our practice. So staying connected in the body, then when we're going into reactivity and we listen to the body, and then we can turn our attention and bring that inquiry, like, where is the craving, where is the clinging, what's happening, can I bring that wedge of mindfulness to stop the reactivity from developing. I don't know if I digressed, but I was talking about Sangha, and I don't think I completed what I wanted to say, that there are communities, there are ways of connecting with others in practice, and it's very enriching to do so, very supportive, and really we gain so much from, and we give so much. You know, we give and we gain. It's very mutual to be with a community in practice. So whether it's if you have a community nearby in Ottawa and Montreal, there are some practice communities, and maybe in Kingston, if you're in other regions in Toronto, there are some. But there are also now ways of connecting online with people, and connecting online with teachers, and then coming on retreats. You know, to do at least one or two retreats a year is a great thing to do to support your practice. So Stephen and I are going to give a Dharma talk later. There's going to be a walking practice, and then we're going to. I know Stephen's going to at least touch on right speech and maybe some other things. I'm going to talk a little bit about practice and relationships, and which of course is connected to right speech also. I'll just end what I'm saying for now. There's a lot that can be said about practice in daily life. I'd like to open for a few questions, and there'll also be some questions when we have the Dharma talks. But maybe there are a few questions about practice in daily life, and then we'll have a bit of time for sitting. Does anybody have any question about practice in daily life?
The five precepts that we committed to here, I've tried committing to those at home, and I grew up Catholic, so when you commit a sin, you usually go to confession. And I really want to commit to the practice and to commit to those precepts, but fail sometimes, and I just want to know how, what you do when you fail, because I feel like then I know that when bhikkhus join a sangha, form a sangha, they can be sent away if they don't follow their precepts. So I don't know.
Well, yeah, it's pretty serious for them to be expelled from the sangha.
Yeah,
but. The precepts are different from the I don't know what they're called in the church, but the rules.
The Ten Commandments usually.
Well, the Ten Commandments, but then also there are also all the Catholic. They added a few, didn't they?
Yeah. The sacraments.
Yeah, the sacraments and all that. Yeah, but the precepts are really seen as training guidelines. You know, they're not rules that if you break them you need to confess, although, you know, if you're working with a teacher, you might want to talk to a teacher about it if it's something that is really problematic. It's a beautiful, wonderful practice to train with the precepts and to deepen in that sense of ethical integrity. It actually it brings a lot of joy, and it brings a lot of a sense of safety to those who are around you, that you've deeply committed not to harm others. So it's that's really wonderful, and I encourage you in that. You know, if you feel that, you know, sometimes we break a precept, and you know, maybe it has to do with, you know, there's a guideline, and different teachers interpret it different ways, about not taking intoxicants, which cause heedlessness. You know, so maybe you know, you feel you had too much wine or something, and it did, you did get tipsy, and so that's just something, you know, to reflect on, to learn from. But then it might be that you said something that was untrue to somebody, or said something harsh, you know, and maybe you want to go to that person and correct it. So you know, the Buddha said, in the Stephen referred in his talk to this teaching of the Buddha that he gave to his son Rahula. You know, he said, Rahula, if you know, and he talked about thought, speech, and action. He said, if you're going to use your mind in some intentional way to plan something, or you know, if you're going to think about something, or if you're going to say something or do something, first reflect, will this cause harm? Then while you're thinking, speaking, and acting, reflect, is this causing harm? You know, and if it will cause harm, don't do it. If it is causing harm, stop doing it. And then after you've thought, spoken, or reflected, or acted, you know, reflect, did it cause harm? And he said, go and repair. Go and you know, correct what you've done. So it's if you feel that, I think what's most meaningful is if you feel that you've caused harm, to correct it. You know, it can be very powerful for yourself and the other, even if it was something long ago, to go back and confess to somebody that you've caused harm. When I was practicing with a teacher, and we were doing some intensive practice and doing ethical investigation, you know, something, the kind of self-reflection of, you know, is there any unfinished business, anything that I have left, you know, that needs to be repaired in my past. And I remembered that I had borrowed $100 from somebody and never paid it back. And that was about 25 years ago. And I found that person, and I contacted him, and he remembered. And he asked me to come and see him. And he said, you know, I'd really like for you to come. And we did. We reconnected. We talked. He said, don't worry about paying me back. I mean, probably be a lot more than that with today's dollars with interest. But no, he just forgave me. And it was, you know, it was beautiful for me to close that chapter, because it felt unresolved. And I think it was also healing for him to know that I remembered, and that I cared, and that I felt remorseful for that that breaking of ethics. So, but I think it's for us to discover, but to live in a way that we don't. So if we say harsh words, you know, if we're not mindful in the moment, to as soon as we can, to go back and acknowledge that we were harsh. To try not to leave hurts and unfinished business. This teacher, Matthew Flickstein, that I worked with, he would say, we can live a life without issues. We can live a life without issues. And that's challenging.